your favorite source for Chicago White Sox talk, delivering news, interviews, analysis, and more. This is the Sox Machine Podcast with your hosts, Jim Margulis, James Fegan, and Josh Nelson.
Thanks, Rob, and welcome to the Sox Machine Podcast. I'm your host, Josh Nelson, and it's Thursday night, August 14th, 2025, as we record this episode. The Chicago White Sox had another tough series loss to an American League Central opponent, this time to Detroit, as the White Sox lost 2 out of 3 at home. The one win, though, was very fun. A death by a thousand paper cuts mixed in with the home run from Edgar Caro to win 9-6 this past Tuesday. That home run for Caro was using a torpedo bat. So more usage of this particular bat style. We'll learn more about Caro's goals with the new bat. Martin Perez is back. We'll chat about his return performance and ponder what's next for him. Also, Shane Smith seems to be getting back to his early season self. This weekend, the White Sox will visit Kansas City for a 3-game series, but while the White Sox are away, the Savannah Bananas visit Wrigley Field. I'll have the latest details of the weekend, which should feature capacity crowds visiting the South Side. In the end, we'll take a moment and look at the Major League Baseball postseason picture as we enter the final quarter of the 2025 season. Let's get started. Joining me are Sox Machines beat reporter James Fegan and managing editor Jim Margulis. And hello, Jim and James. The White Sox lose another series against an American League Central opponent. The White Sox this year are 44-77. They're only 25 and a half games back of first place Detroit. And there, we talked about this winning percentage discrepancy against the American League Central. Now in 2025, the White Sox are 9-24. That's a .273 winning percentage over 162 games at the 44 win pace. Against everyone else, the White Sox are 35-53. That's a .398 winning percentage or a 64 win pace over 162. One of the positives, though, from this series to take away is that Martin Perez returned to the mound for the first time since April 18th against Boston. Perez went 3 1/3 innings, allowed just 3 hits, 1 earned run, 2 walks, and struck out 4. White Sox manager Will Venable shared his thoughts on how Perez looked.
It was outstanding. First couple of batters there, we just didn't have the command that we know he has. Nice job by Ethan. We busy get the mechanics back, and obviously did a great job from there. The Martin that we saw earlier in the season. So for his journey this year and have him come and do what he did today was awesome.
James, Perez is back. How did he look to you? How does he feel? What's next for Martin Perez?
Those first couple hitters, he was looking a little shaky because just in general, like Martin Perez's stuff, like if he's not commanding, it looks very vulnerable very quickly. But he did stabilize and he did hit 91. So he's kind of like up from some starts he had in April. And he was able to like attack hitters very aggressively in the zone. Like the more his outing went on, I almost thought like I think he got up to 3 2/3 the second rehab outing. I thought he might finish the game the way things were situated. They did pull him, but he looked like Martin Perez. I'm not expecting that to be anything crazy, but he seems to still be able to do his thing. And he said he had no pain and no issues afterwards. And I think as the more he's kind of been confident about he is coming back, the more he's kind of revealed like, yeah, they were telling me if like I had to go under the knife again, that was probably it. So there was a second opinion that he got from Meister, who cut open so many White Sox arms this spring that actually told him he didn't need surgery, and he was like, "All right, I can run it out," because this would be his second TJ if he went under the knife again. Got a lot of miles on that entire area in general. Maybe the prospects weren't so good, so. He feels great. What his future is going to be, I don't know. Because Will Venable, simultaneously, their rotation is like undergoing so much change. Like basically every start of this past series was something like they kind of announced like the night before. Or I think Yoandrés Gómez was even like the day of. So they've been hesitant to kind of stake out what the roles are for anyone. But Will Venable quite notably did not say like he's going to start his next time. But also said like, he's probably pretty used to a regular schedule. We're going to try to use him regularly. So Does that mean piggybacking him with Shane Smith, where Shane Smith continually gets shaved down and Martin goes up? Or is it just that they're changing things week to week? And I don't know, is Yoenndris Gomez the easiest staff now and they have to build everything around that? I don't know. It's they've been slapping things together. It's definitely been creative. So we could put that feather in their cap. That's still novel to see around here.
the way that you use creative, excellent. Yeah, shout out to Gomez. He pitched great on Tuesday. Really surprised me on how well he threw against Detroit. So this whole idea, Jim, of possibly piggybacking Martin Perez and Shane Smith. So looking at it from the Martin Perez perspective first, do you like this idea? Because their stuff is so different.
I like the idea in theory, where the White Sox have six starters, and if they were trying to integrate a guy like Smith into the rotation at the end of a long season, like say, let's say he's equivalent of like a Noah Schultz type or like a prospect they're calling up, and they don't want to gas him, but they want to get him some experience, piggybacking him with a starter that sounds good. And like having a veteran like Martin Perez to do that with gives the coaching staff a sense of stability, makes it a little less high maintenance for them, because the veteran presumably knows what he's doing on a given day, so less hand holding in that regard. So it makes sense on paper. I just think with this particular rotation, the way they're scrambling on the fly, if Perez is a just Yeah, a normal starter who can be used normally 5+ innings, and Smith is a starter who can be used 5 innings, even if they are, maybe trying to wind him down a little bit. It does seem like a misallocation of resources to use two of those guys on the same day and then invariably leave them scrambling for 1 or 2 days, the rest of the week, where they don't know who's going. They have to do some kind of calling up a fresh arm. Probably some guys have to look into it to see if they are running against their limit on waiver exposures or being optioned down before they're required to go through waivers. But that's why, like at this time, it feels like a little bit messy. Like we've seen Will Venable use the opener unapologetically. This seems like it's more of a Rick Renteria opener of we have two guys who need to throw. One guy is somebody we're not stretch out of the way. Another guy's trying to get healthy. Let's put them both in the same day, but let's not make a long-term arrangement out of it. Like I think this feels like one of those where it makes sense in a given week, but as the rest of the last quarter unfolds, probably something you can't count on doing very often.
Well, as James said, it's a very creative process, Jim.
Yeah, no, it's there. It's a Second City improv. Just yes, and you and Dresand.
My mom would always call it like creative driving when like someone would like do a 3-point turn in the middle of the street while like blocking both lanes of traffic or something like
Yep,
that.
I see that a lot in Bridgeport. I see that a lot
That your
in
mom's version of
Bridgeport.
cursing? Like, oh, creative, instead of something she really wants to say.
It's where some instinct to just say something sardonic while suppressing your emotions while response to what you're seeing. What are those skills that I have in that respect? That's the origin.
Yeah, the my equivalent now that I have a 3-year-old in the car who will repeat what I say is if I go for the F word, I have to say figure it out to the driver ahead
Okay.
of me. So yeah, figure it out and getting in that habit to where that's my go-to F word now.
All right, so that's Martin Perez. And for his breaking off a lot of rust, again, he had not pitched in a game in the majors since mid-April. I'm optimistic in what he can provide to the White Sox for the rest of the season. And who knows? Maybe this is the last hurrah for Martin Perez in his career.
And that has to be the first positive association with Keith Meister, right? In terms of like a story that doesn't like involve a guy missing the next year of his life.
Yeah, but also like the message was like a little ominous. It's like when I visit you again, it'll be the end, the sort of thing, rather than
Oh God.
goodbye forever.
Oh
It's
my.
like, do you really want to do this now? Because I don't think you'll come back from it. So
Do not touch me. I am death.
I would rest in rehab.
Wow. Oh man. All right.
He was
Well,
very blunt about where he was. Like, it's.
yeah, I guess so. I guess so. Well, welcome back, Martin Perez, and we'll see at his next outing. Might be on this mini road trip the White Sox have. I'm not sure if we'll see him in Kansas City, but maybe the next time in Atlanta. Again, Martin Perez piggybacked with Shane Smith on Wednesday. And Shane Smith, he pitched five scoreless innings against Detroit, allowing two hits. He walked three, but he struck out five. In his last two outings, Smith has covered 10 innings, allowing just six hits, two earned runs, four walks, but with 13 strikeouts. Here's what Will Venable thought about Smith's last start.
Shane was great. It was two starts in a row now where the stuff looked like it did in the beginning of the season. He's attacking the zone, a good fastball. His off-speed stuff was good. It was just the Shane that we were used to, and really nice to see him get back to that here a couple times in a row.
James, it appears that Smith is getting closer to his former self this season. What's been working for Shane Smith?
Well, he's still throwing hard as hell, so that's really good. That's helpful for him. Probably can't focus on that enough. I think, and that's a big question as far as like he crossed 100 innings. How well is he going to hold like the stuff he flashed in spring training? He hasn't had so many like 97 to 99 days like he did against the Mariners in March, but I think he's been consistently like a tick or two above the guy that the Brewers passed on the previous season. So he's been holding that pretty well the last couple starts, and you know, responding a little bit better in terms of he seemed a little out of whack routine wise when they gave him extra days in the past. He obviously hasn't had the same issues while they gave him extra rest this time. And he talked a little bit about like what he was thinking grip wise to fix the off speed command issues that he had. And he was able to use his changeup a lot better against, you know, his last couple starts. And even if he didn't throw any like sliders really at all this last start, it was kind of a lefty heavy lineup, and he really was able to be effective with his curveball. So his stuff looked sharp again when he was able to command it. He talked about just getting on top of the ball, and like it kind of starts moving too laterally when he starts kind of cheating for movement a little bit. And so he's trying to stay disciplined in that and let his grips do the work. And it seems like it's been working of recent. And for him to not have his stuff dissipate in any major way and finding out being able to execute some command cues to get him back on looks pretty positive. I don't know. I think he knows when he talks, like he wants to build up as big of any base as he can this year, because he knows he's going to be fighting them to how many innings he can throw next year. So I'm sure he'd love to get up to 120 so that he has the leash to go to 150 or 160 next season, but it's going to be something that's in scale with the 90 that he did last year. And we'll see how far they let him stretch out. I'm sure looking really good can only help him kind of continue to get, basically a full length start that he got this last time out.
Yeah, on that point, Jim, Smith's already at 21 starts this season. If he can finish out the rest of the season, he's going to make 28 starts. He's got a chance to reach 125, maybe even 135 innings this year. If Smith can finish out this season with 28 starts and finishes strong, does that give you confidence that he can take on a heavier workload, or is the travesty that we saw this spring training a concern with so many arms that burnt out?
I think there are the standard pitcher caveats at play of just like they could go at any time. Every pitch could be their last to go back into the super dark Martin Perez discourse here of just it's a doomed position and there's always they deserve hazard pay. But when it comes to like just the way he's been able to build up, and it does seem like a responsible innings increase from going from 90 something to, you know, hopefully 120 something, 130, to where you do get on the doorstep of being able to qualify for the ERA title with 162 innings. Like, seems good, seems fine. Like, you know, there's always the case of, we've seen it with like Jonathan Cannon of getting optioned down and, you know, getting a injury here. We've seen Davis Martin get injured, miss some time. So I think like you can't necessarily count on anybody being a horse when they haven't shown the ability to be it yet. But like everything else about the way he's been able to build up, the way he's maintaining stuff, the way it seems like he's been able to correct himself midseason with a little bit of rest. Like the White Sox were able to pull him back a little bit and then, you know, get him on track. Seems like everybody's being responsible, yet letting him pitch enough to where it's not like the, you know, Noah Schultz plan or the Tanner McDougal plan of just like once a week, three or four innings. And yeah, I'm kind of skeptical on how much you can learn about a guy working under regular starter workloads. You know, we're trying to project that. But in the case of Smith throwing like five innings, 80 plus pitches every time out, and pitching mostly every five games. You know, sometimes they give him extra day of rest here and there, but you know, he's not, they're not sacrificing the shape of the rotation around him. Seems like they're doing about as best as they can. And, you know, thinking about the Brewers leaving him unprotected, it's like, they're laughing about Andrew Vaughn now, or at least they're, you know, they're very satisfied with getting Andrew Vaughn for basically free. And it's like, well, the White Sox got Shane Smith for free. So if you count it as a Andrew Vaughn for Shane Smith and Aaron Civale trade, it kind of gets closer. And then if you throw in Bryce Wilson and everybody else that they've acquired from them, like then it starts getting pretty messy accounting. So I think you have to cut it off at some point, but it is nice to have him for free.
Would people anyone be upset? White Sox have turned Tyler Alexander into a monster.
True. Yes. Another one. He's the guy you tandem for four innings. He's the guy you piggyback with. Like, I think if you have two lefties or piggybacking, I think that's one too many.
Maybe they can piggyback off each other. Perez can start and then Alexander follows up. It feels like the same guy pitching the entire game. Now, would anyone be disappointed or sad if I banned future Andrew Vaughn conversations on this podcast? Because my meatball take of this show is I'm sick of it.
I think you have to
actually
wear it.
I'm low key pissed about it. Okay.
Like, you never want to discuss it again?
Not really. I know it exists. I know it's out there. We'll talk about the Brewers later in the show. Because
like
won
how far would it have
games.
To go before like couldn't be ignored? Like if he's winning World Series MVP, do we have to like acknowledge it?
Yes, we have to acknowledge it. Yes, if he wins World Series MVP. He pulls a Paul Konerko and hits a grand slam.
On a right-handed slider.
Where is this
really
been?
Stick it to you.
Yeah, just really stick it to me. Where the hell has this been? Negative 1.3 war. One of the worst position players in all of Major League Baseball before the White Sox optioned him. And now this? Yeah.
Not hot before. He's a talented hitter.
Not like this. No, don't even start. Not anything like this. This is ridiculous. White Sox never made a shirt for him. The Brewers did. Oh, all right. Let me know, podcast listeners, if you want me to further ban any Andrew Vaughn talk, let me know. But my meatball take is I'm low-key pissed off at Andrew Vaughn.
What if the hard hit rates were right the whole time and people just lacked the faith to statistical regression?
Also, I don't think that's low-key pissed. You sound medium key pissed.
You're probably more accurate, Jim. No, his expected stats weren't even this good. Maybe he's cheating. We'll go with that.
You want that to happen. You want that to be.
Oh, man. Okay. So hopefully someone that's going to get a boost out of the bat that they're using, Edgar Carroll. He is joining the Torpedo Bat Club along with Colson Montgomery. And in the win this series against the Tigers, Carroll had a big game. He hit his fourth home run of the season. He went 3-for-5, picked up 3 RBIs. But there are very noticeable split differences for Edgar Carroll. When he's facing right-handed pitching, he's hit more home runs. 3 of his 4 home runs have been against right-handed pitchers. But his OPS is 609. It's a .299 off base percentage, and he's slugging just .310 against righties. Against lefties, it's one home run, but Carroll's batting .370 with a .408 on base percentage and slugging .489. That's an .897 OPS. So James, with the torpedo bat, is Carroll hoping to get the same kind of boost that Colson Montgomery has seen with the bat, or does he have different goals?
He has been having troubles hitting left-handed against right-handed velocity inside on him and keeping up on it, and obviously having issues with fastball coverage in a certain area and becoming conscious of it can lead to chase issues and other problems as far as like being on time with other areas. He mostly expressed it as an issue with timing. And what Edgar said is that he felt like he was drawing his hands too low in his load with that swing, and he was not getting on plane or like catching up with fastballs. Like he was drawing too big of a drawdown move. And he felt that the weight distribution of the torpedo bat, this explanation might be missing as someone who like understands physics to like really drive it home, but he felt like the weight distribution was helping him, the difference in it was helping him not make that move as distinctly, and that he was catching up to inner half velocity a little better. And obviously the home run that he hit was like 93 right up and in on him. So like you saw him watch it all the way out and be super pumped about it. He had like three hits against right-handers on that night. Since like, I want to say like July 1st, he's been pretty good against right-handers. It's like a 50 something plate appearance sample, but like, and obviously the way his season numbers speak to how much he was really struggling against right-handers for a lot of the time. But it's looking at least a little better of recent, and he has like a mechanical thing that he kind of can point to about it. And you know, he had that big game against Detroit, but it was Sunday that I really noticed he had like three at bats against right-handers and like big runners in scoring positions spots against the Mariners. Again, they lost, and he struck out twice, and I think he lined out the other time. Like it didn't go well, and I was kind of wondering like, why was he not pitch hit for? And when I tried to find a gentle way of asking Will Venable about it like the next day, he kind of said like, well, you know, we've kind of seen him settle in. Like, we don't think maybe the gap for making that move is as big as it used to be. So we didn't think it quite had the upside to incur the complications it would make. So clearly they're believing in Edgar Caro hitting right against right-handers a bit more than they were before. And the way he said it, he said like his torpedo bat broke in a second at bat that night of his home run. So he might have hit the home run with a normal bat, what he's saying. But he also said that he liked swinging with them so much that he was clearly going to go back to it. Or just like he was kind of convinced, like, if I'm going to make this adjustment, I'm going to make it. And that's why he was going to commit it. He's kind of wired that way where he commits to things. So we'll see. But he says he feels a lot more comfortable swinging with it, and you know, talked about like the hand load movement and like feeling better with it. So he's pretty specific on what he thinks of the issue is, and that's what he thinks of Stackland.
Okay, no, that's really good insight. Alan Nathan, famously in baseball circles, physicist down at the University of Illinois, Sabre seminar is coming up at IIT in Chicago. Later this month, he's going to do a whole presentation about the torpedo bat. I'm really curious to hear about his presentation and his findings about this particular piece of equipment. Anything that could, we know obviously the impact of Colson Montgomery, and it is helping Montgomery quite a bit. Anything to help Caro, Jim, against right-handed pitching, because if these numbers continue, I guess to look at it a positive spin, Edgar Caro and Kyle Teal have figured out their platoon moving forward. Instead of debating who should get more playing time, will be quite easy. A left-handed pitcher on the mound, you go to Edgar Caro. A right-handed pitcher on the mound, you go to Kyle Teal. But I don't think that's the desired outcome, right?
Well, and what's, you know, James alluded to it, but in the second half, Caro actually has a better OPS against righties than Teal does.
That's not good.
It's it's an 894 to 734. Like Caro is actually been pretty
great for Caro.
Yeah, it's great for Caro. It's only 37 at bats. I'm looking at baseball musings because they do it by date. So yeah, it's about like 42, 43 plate appearances. So not a huge sample. It's about 52 or so for Teal. So small sample, but in terms of like showing what he can show over this given time, and given that, you know, Caro only has one season to go off of, he's showing the progress he wants. But yeah, it does. I think if the platoon isn't clean, I think that's when it gets to be a real interesting discussion, because in a world where Teal is hitting righties and Kiro is hitting lefties, and they're both young and sharing the load when it comes to learning the pitching staff, and they each have different strengths when it comes to the work behind the plate, like you can balance it out. But when one starts encroaching on the other's signature, whether it's, you know, hitting righties better or hitting lefties better, or somebody takes a distinct lead in framing, the other defensive components blocking and throwing, then I think you kind of get the choice to choose one. And, you know, my thought the entire time is because they already had Kiro and they traded for Teal, that they'd lean towards Teal. Like, or that would be like kind of maybe the tiebreaker, is if they needed to trade one to address a shortcoming elsewhere, they would go with the guy they acquired secondary or second, knowing what they had in Kiro. But I am curious, if Kiro continues hitting righties the way that he does and he's strong against lefties and his receiving's okay, you know, it's for a young catcher, like you anticipated improving some, but like it's been fine. And you know, I think it's more stable than Teal's. Like Teal has drawn a few catcher's interferences this year. I think he's a little bit more jumpy behind the plate, whereas Kiro, I think, is more, I think presents a more stable glove back there. Then I think it gets real interesting in terms of, what more does Kiro need to do to play a starter's workload, even if he already have Teal? And then are they willing to trade Teal, even though they just acquired him and thought he'd be the guy and like his athleticism more? So I don't think we're close to there yet, but it does present an interesting conundrum if this is more like than a hot streak or more than an aberration, the way Caro's hitting righties right now, and he actually figures out, because, you know, Kiro is, he has the ability to figure stuff out. Like he's a smart driven dude, I think. And I think he can be discounted just because of his background, because of his size and such. And so like, you can't count him out.
When it comes to this whole catching conversation defensively, like Baseball Savant thinks neither guy is that great at blocking right now. They're both below average, -1, -2 blocking runs. Throwing, they're very similar. Teal has a stronger arm. Kyle Teal is averaging 81.6 miles per hour behind home plate. Caro's averaging 78.4 miles per hour. But it's the framing. -7 runs below average framing for Edgar Kiro, but neither, and you wrote about this, James, neither have a strike rate above 40% this year. I think it's too young to be concerned. Like they're too young, too green to be concerned about their defensive ability in the majors. But is this something that the White Sox, like Drew Butera, that he's constantly working with both Teal and in Caro's case in trying to improve on these defensive metrics?
Yeah. I mean, you don't want to be last in the league. Even if you generally assume that they're going to develop and get better, you'd like them hanging tough in the early going a bit more than they have, I would think. Yeah, Carroll's been like, both over the off season was like making mechanical changes and has recently been like loading his glove like more to his body at the start. Recent, like, I haven't seen like big strides in the strike rate, but you know, he's kind of a lot more on Teal in terms of like framing runs lost because he's just had more playing time, but Their rates are pretty similar, and Teal was actually a little bit more ahead, and Kiro caught up a little bit. But generally, they especially come from what he did in AAA, or from what I understand, Teal's framing numbers in AAA, like they viewed him as like the better framer, at least when he came in. I feel like they've narrowed that a bit, but it's also neither one is exceptional, obviously, like at this rate. And there are other elements in terms of like pitch calling and just, presenting and targeting that like Carroll's been pretty solid at. And I think the view of his defense is a bit beyond like last in framing, would say, and especially in terms of like progress. So yeah, I think they're both kind of undergrad. Like Teal also had like his own little mechanical glove arm load change that he was working on the offseason. So I think they've been kind of hands-on with them a lot. But yeah, it's something that you are hoping is part of their adjustment process, that it's as low as it's been so far.
Yeah, it'd be something to focus on next spring training and a lot of those questions entering camp. Like, what did Caro and Teal do to get better defensively? There's quite a bit of work that both of them have to do to improve as far as in game calling and pitch blocking, pitch framing. I mean, how many more seasons do we have until the system, the automated balls and strikes challenge system, comes into play? Do we even know how that impacts
wipe it out entirely?
Yeah, okay. No, I've watching AAA games. Once they change it from three challenges to two, that made a big difference in terms of how willing hitters or you see it with hitters' faces more than like pitcher reactions. In terms of, you see like a hesitation and like, no, I can't challenge, we're down to one, or the leverage isn't there to make this, using this last bullet worth it. If like a seam catches the edge of the zone, it's a wasted challenge. So like, you can early in counts, you really don't see the helmet taps or the hat taps. And over the course of a game, like, they usually use all two, but if a challenge is lost early and they're down to one with like eight innings to go, I think a good framing catcher can pile up a ton of value, especially early in counts, to where like that challenge will not be used.
Okay. No, that's good to know. So, I mean, both of them have to be better as far as defensively, and we'll continue to watch that. Again, they're green. They're learning on how to be a major league catcher, but anything for Edgar Caro to help him out.
They are the two youngest catchers in the majors.
They are the youngest.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's like I said, it's too early to be worried about what they can do defensively, but anything for Caro to help him out against right-handed pitching, all for it. So we're not automatically assuming if this continues a year later, be like, all right, here, now the White Sox have a perfect platoon between Caro and Teal, but I know that's not the desired outcome.
Yeah, Caro does have, like, when it comes to catcher ERA and OPS allowed and such, he does have the superior numbers there. 692 OPS allowed, Teal's allowed 783 OPS.
Wow.
I mean, that comes down to some, you know, issues.
You know, pitchers like, and quality.
Yeah. And the White Sox have used so many pitchers that it's hard to really build up a sample. But like, I'm looking at the player splits, and Adrian Hauser with Caro behind the plate, 563 OPS. In Teal's three starts, Adrian Hauser gave up a 928 OPS. So in case, he's somebody who was like good basically all the time. And, Hauser, it seems like he saved all of his rough starts for the Teal ones, but it is, I think it does point to some either game calling or other issues where Caro is able to help out a pitcher beyond raw framing numbers, perhaps.
Got it. Yeah. Like I said, the defense and everything work in progress, and we'll continue to watch them progress going to next season, but anything for Caro to help him out against right-handed pitching, I'm all for it. So we'll see if he continues using the torpedo bat. If he gets on a power surge like Colson Montgomery has with the torpedo bat, all for it. Everyone swing with a torpedo bat at that stage. Whatever helps score more runs. The White Sox were shut out 1-0 in their last game against Detroit. While the Chicago White Sox will be on the road visiting Kansas City, and we'll preview that series in a moment, Wrigley Field will be rocking this weekend as the Savannah Bananas make their first visit to Chicago on the south side. Both games are sold out at Wrigley Field, so it'll be more than 40,000 people at each game on Saturday and Friday. In Lot B will be the pregame plaza held by the Savannah Bananas. That's going to start at 2 p.m. Central Time on both days. Now, the Bananas will have merchandise tents. Their early openings are from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. both on Friday and Saturday. Please note that prepaid parking at the stadium for either game, if you don't have prepaid parking, is already sold out. So if you don't have a parking pass and you have plans on driving to the game, you need to immediately head to McCormick Place Lot B off 31st Street. That's right next to Lakeshore Drive, and then take a shuttle to the stadium. The schedule events are both days. So on Friday, August 15th, will be the pregame plaza. You need to have a ticket for the game in order to attend the pregame plaza. That starts at 2 p.m. Central Time. The Bananas players will make appearances also at that time. Before the Peel pregame show starts at 3 p.m., the gates open at Raitt Field at 4:30, and the game will start around 6:30 p.m. Central Time. Those times are the same as well for Saturday for all the pregame events. All the pregame events for the Bananas will be hosted in Lot B. If you are attending these games and you haven't been to a White Sox game this season, the bag policy is just like the White Sox game. You are limited. Recommendation is if you have one of those clear bags for NFL games like the Chicago Bears, that works perfectly. You can't bring an umbrella. Purses will be searched at the game. All merchandise and all concessions at Raitt Field are cashless. And if you don't have tickets but still want to hang out in Bridgeport to enjoy the experience of the Bananas being in town, our friends at the Remova Theater are hosting a watch party on Friday night, and you could visit the Remova Theater off 35th and Halstead. Next for the Chicago White Sox, they head on the road. They'll be visiting Kansas City this weekend, and then after Kansas City, they'll be visiting Atlanta. The Royals are getting close to being back to 500, and they're kind of in the postseason race. The Royals are 60-61 this year at their third place in the American League Central. They're 9.5 games back in Detroit. They're 4 games back at the final wildcard spot. They lost their last game, and they're 5-5 in their last 10. Against the White Sox, though, this season, they are 5-2 at Kauffman Stadium. They are 30-29. Your pitching problems for this series starting on Friday night, 7:10 p.m. Central Time. Aaron Civale will take the ball for the White Sox against left-handed pitcher Noah Cameron, who has a 2.52 ERA this year for the Royals. Saturday night, 6:10 p.m. Central Time. Sean Burke, will talk more about him in a moment here, against right-handed pitcher Michael Lorenzen. And then on Sunday, getaway day, Davis Martin, the Darts, will take the ball for the White Sox against Ryan Burgert of the Royals. So I mentioned Sean Burke, and Sean Burke's already hit a career high, even when you include the minor leagues this season, with 114 innings pitched. He could reach 150 innings this season if he continues his normal workload. James, are you hearing possibly shaving off some innings for Sean Burke? Are the White Sox going to start slowing him down?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know how hard and aggressively it's going to come, but I would expect him to. I wouldn't be surprised to see like a 3-inning start at some point with him. And certainly, whether it's Cannon coming back or Uendry's being used as like a multi-inning guy behind him, but like they're kind of accumulating this mass of multi-inning / six starters that can kind of tide it over. So I don't know how soon it happened. It certainly seemed like should be full go, or at least still close to like getting 5 innings in Kansas City, but I wouldn't be surprised if it happens at some point. And if like when they did it with Smith, it's kind of like, oh, he's leaving, why? And then we find out afterwards.
Does Tyler Alexander have a chance of leading the team in innings pitch, Jim? Because right now it seems like he may have to pitch every second day going 4 innings.
Be like the Colson Montgomery leading the home runs, leading the White Sox in home runs of innings, just spotting them, everybody else a huge lead, and then coming roaring through at the end.
I joke. I mean, Alexander's only at 41 innings. You'd have to like pitch 80. But the more we talk about the pitching staff for the White Sox and how they're going to finish this season, it's like, yeah, Tyler Alexander's going to get a lot more innings.
Seems like he's just happy to handle whatever they throw at him. So I think they could try to just pile on until they break him.
Yeah. So with Sean Burke at 114 innings, he leads White Sox pitchers in that regard. He was the opening day starter for the White Sox. And let's say, Jim, that they start slowing him down. What are your, I guess, early thoughts before we give him a final season grade after the season of what you've seen from Sean Burke in 2025?
I think it's been okay. I think in terms of like the long-term viability of him being like more than a number four starter, perhaps, is just like it's a chore sometimes watching him against lefties. Especially lineups that have a ton of lefties, when it's balanced, I think he has enough to get by. But I think when watching like the Guardians stack 8 lefties against him and just having to go fastball, curve, fastball, curve, fastball, curve, for four plus innings, and he was locating his fastball well, but just how many times can you grab strikes with a curveball when it's probably more of a swing and miss pitch or more of a strike grabbing pitch, but in terms of like quality curveballs in the zone for strikes when that's your go-to against lefties. How often can you do that? I know he was trying to get a changeup going, but it doesn't really seem like that's taken hold. So in his current form, like he's good arm. He's showing some durability and some resilience. And given the starting pitcher shortages all over the league, like you can use him. Like he's perfectly viable as somebody to start a game every 5 days. It's just like the opening day type, the billing for him, I think, was a one-off thing. And now it's just more a matter of, can they shape him up into something more than just a big arm, but not the biggest arm you've ever seen. And, not enough to where like his fastball can define him. When it's only a curveball and like a slider against righties, which is okay, but not really having that changeup or that changeup type element against lefties, I think that's probably the white whale for him.
If I told you only 57 pitchers right now in Major League Baseball qualify for the ERA title, is that right on, too many or fewer than you were expecting, Jim?
Seems like a little more than I was expecting.
Okay.
Like not a whole lot of guys going 160 innings. Perhaps that number gets winnowed down a bit as they start easing up on workloads or, injuries take hold or such. But I would expect maybe 35 or something like that would be my guess for 160 inning guys.
I'll answer. I feel like that total represents the dissolution of values and principles in this country that once made it something to be proud of. It hurts my heart to hear that.
Oh, it sucks. Yeah, it definitely does.
Yeah, 'cause it's like,
bring back James Shields.
It's like each team gets two guys. Each team gets two starting pitchers that's going to qualify for the ERA title. I mean, it makes voting for the Cy Young easy. It's a small pool to pull from.
Yeah, last year was 58. So I think I was thrown off by number of American League. When I probably looked it up as more American League pitchers, but 58 across Major League Baseball last year.
Who decides what the innings limit is to qualify for the ERA title?
Just one per game.
Yeah.
So 162.
Does that need to change? Do we need to have a conversation?
They need to change.
Yeah.
It's them who sucks.
James is adamant about that one. Okay.
Maybe eventually. I don't know. But I like it because now it thins the herd of all these people who aren't actually posting like super often. So it actually feels like the workload cutoff actually feels like the ERA title winds up going to like a really legit, reliable starting pitcher more than, someone who got weak contact for 150 innings or something like, or not 100, but 162 innings back when that wasn't really a lot of innings. I'm trying to think like when Kyle Hendricks won the ERA title, like he was way below. It was like a nice thing for him, but he wasn't actually in the tier of someone who would win a Cy Young because his innings were so far back. But like the ERA title was a relatively low threshold for that, even though they were pulling him like after two turns of the order all the time. But now Kyle Hendricks threw 190 innings or whatever he did when he won the ERA title, would be like, this is an amazing season for anyone. So it's just depressing.
It's like the Blake Snell effect of just like, if he throws more than 130 innings, he wins the Cy Young. Like the two times he's done it, he's thrown 180 innings.
The first Blake Snell Cy Young that I was a voter for. I voted for Cole.
Logan Webb leads the majors in innings pitched, 153 and two thirds. Old friend Garrett Crochet, second in Major League Baseball at 152 and a third innings this year. Christopher Sanchez also at 150 innings. So
that's why we're good being Garrett, because I respect him.
Yeah, another old friend, Carlos Rodon, at 146 innings. Wasn't that long ago I was worried that his arm would fall off after 125 innings in a season. Maybe things will change, but But Sean Burke, I mean, if the White Sox continue his workload, he's got a chance to reach 150 innings. He's the best option for the White Sox to qualify for the ERA title. But based on what James said and the White Sox and the way the White Sox are handling their young pitchers, especially in light of what happened during spring training, I understand if they start slowing him down. The innings, I guess, winner or leader for the White Sox this year might be 135, 140 this year. Nobody for the White Sox will qualify for the ERA title in 2025. And of course, with the White Sox and Royals, we always have to pay attention to how in the world are they going to pitch to Bobby Witt Jr. in 50 games in his career against the White Sox. Bobby Witt Jr. is batting 325 with a 366 on base percentage, slugging 503. Shocker, because it's not that great of an offensive season for Bobby Witt Jr. compared to past seasons. It's still a 125 weighted runs created plus, and he has 30 stolen bases. But Bobby Witt Jr. has the fourth highest WAR in Major League Baseball right now. According to Fangraphs, he's at 5.7 WAR. If the season were to end today, he's probably an American League MVP finalist, along with Aaron Judge and Cal Raleigh. So Bobby Witt Jr., again, continues to own the White Sox. We'll see if the White Sox have any plans for Bobby Witt this weekend. We'll recap that White Sox-Royals series on Sunday. I'll also have further reporting from right field, as I'll be watching the Savannah Bananas for the first time as they play their game or perform, however you want to call it, on Friday night at right field. But this is a huge weekend when it comes to especially the National League playoff picture, and we are entering the final quarter of the MLB 2025 season. Starting with the American League, your playoff picture looks like the number one seed, the Blue Jays, have a game lead over Detroit. The Blue Jays are 71-51. The Tigers are 70-52. Those are your top two seeds. They would have the bye. So your 3-4-6 seed matchup would be the Houston Astros and the New York Yankees. And then your 4-5 would be the Seattle Mariners and the Boston Red Sox. The Guardians are currently a game back of the Yankees. The Rangers are 3.5 back. The Royals are 4 back. We'll see if the Royals have a big series against the White Sox if they inch closer to the Yankees. The key series in the American League, though, this weekend is the Texas Rangers at the Toronto Blue Jays. But in the National League, the Milwaukee Brewers have won 12 straight games. Their franchise record is 13 straight. And because they won 12 straight, it's George Webb's for everyone in Wisconsin. So if you've been to Wisconsin, the Milwaukee area, George Webb is this greasy diner. Everyone's going to get free cheeseburgers. I know George Webb's more for their hash browns, but the Milwaukee Brewers are 76-44. The Phillies, 69-52. And so are the San Diego Padres. The Padres have won 5 straight. They would technically be the third seed right now. They would face the 6th seed New York Mets. The Chicago Cubs are 68-52. They're the 4th seed. And if the season were to end today, they'd be playing the 5 seed Los Angeles Dodgers in the first round. That would make amazing sports radio fodder in the city of Chicago. The Reds are a game back of the Mets, and the Cardinals are 4 back of the Mets. But the key series this weekend, Jim, Padres and Dodgers. And I know I'm going to have a lot of fun at Wright Field Friday night watching the Savannah Bananas. A lot of friends and family along with me are going to be watching that game, but I might be speed walking home because I think we finally got to the point of the season. This is must watch baseball. If you have MLB.tv, especially with these late night games in Los Angeles, Padres Dodgers at Dodger Stadium, this feels like must watch, Jim.
Yeah, especially the way they get under each other's skin. I think the Padres do it more than Dodgers. I think the Padres are the little brother, so I think they like poking, they like getting a reaction when things are going well, which I like that dynamic. I mean,
the Dodgers kind of suck with this rivalry, though. They're very Cubs like. It's not a rivalry. Yeah. We don't consider the Padres a rival. And it's like, dude, look at the last 5 years. They're really the only ones that challenge you consistently.
Yeah. And I think, you know, right now they can probably, you know, they always take a very long view. Dave Roberts, you know, the way he, or I guess the circumstances under which he has to manage and the pressure that he's had to deal with, like he always has to, you know, withdraw, I think, from the day-to-day stuff and making too big of a thing of any one game or any one series, like even in the postseason, like if he lost enough high profile postseason series to be like, he could have been fired a few times over. Had Andrew Friedman had a more of a hair trigger when it came to managers and thinking that they're more interchangeable. So he's always been rather placid about the rivalry or just any kind of thing that could possibly be big or annoy the Dodgers. Like, he will not indulge that. And I think maybe other players take their cue. Kershaw seems to get a bit ruffled by things, when people point out his postseason failures, but everybody else are more like, yeah, we're the Dodgers. It's part of the luxury of being the Dodgers is that you can say you're too big for everybody else and probably be correct most of the time. But the Padres, I think, I'm pulling for them just in the fact that, like, whenever any team adds aggressively at the deadline, I like to see that aggression rewarded. I like to see big payoffs for big swings, even like in free agency and stuff, or big trades in the offseason. I tend to want to see action rewarded. I don't want to see prospect hoarding be like the default stance for like virtuous. So like Dave Dombrowski doing well, great. AJ Preller doing well, great. The Orioles really struggling this year after not making the trade, like, kind of great. I feel bad for Orioles fans. Like, I want to see Orioles fans be happy, but in terms of like the way that ascent was managed, like, you could see the fault lines and the cracks mm-hmm. open. So in this case, like, I am hoping that the Padres, pull off that big series, that big, either a series win to even have a cushion over the Dodgers, or like a sweep would be something else in terms of just like turning up the pressure in LA. But yeah, I want to see chaos. And I think the Padres having a multi-game lead over the Dodgers in the second half of August going into September, that would be that would be a dynamic we haven't seen.
James, you're going to be on vacation, so no, you should not be watching.
That's right.
No, I in the National League, like, Jim, the Padres and I'm sorry, the Dodgers and Mets are the 5 and 6 seed, and they spend way more money than anyone else. And I'm starting to see this narrative, let's call it MLB Twitter, but on social media, fans are pointing it out, like, yeah, hey, the teams that spend $1 billion, they're struggling right now. And yeah, this series is going to be fascinating. The pitching problems are not even posted right now. We only know that Clayton Kershaw is pitching for the Dodgers, so they're already maybe gaming the system against each other. But I can't wait. I can't wait. So it'll be 9 o'clock Central Time Friday night, 8 o'clock Saturday night, and 3 o'clock on Sunday. So you can watch Padres and Dodgers before the Chicago Bears preseason game against the Buffalo Bills. I know we talked about the Yankees and Mets. The Mets are only 8 games above 500. That's a bit of a surprise. How are you viewing these postseason races, James? Like, especially as far as in the National League.
Well, the Mets lost, so they're now 7 games.
Yeah, they're 7.
Yeah.
Wow. They're only a half game ahead of Cincinnati.
They stink. they shouldn't stink. I don't understand why they stink as bad as they do. Obviously, a White Sox team that was 7 games over 500 in August people would struggle to calm down. Their pitching has been dodgy. Like, Manaea has, I believe, been hurt and hasn't been good yet. Clay Holmes betting on a mediocre starter who got turned into a great reliever and putting him back into the starting rotation has produced a mediocre starter again. Frankie Montas, that was a deal that was criticized a lot of the time because he was couldn't stay healthy and then would perform erratically afterwards. That's held up. So it's a weird for a team that's kind of, it's, I don't want to say people root for them, but they're kind of the example of like, see, shouldn't teams spend because them winning represents that. But they obviously their playoff run redeemed a lot of the weirdness of last season, but they have not been like as reliably dominant as, the resources being pumped into them would suggest they should be. Adding Juan Soto is usually supposed to have pretty good impact. But they're the Mets still.
Yeah, when looking at like the innings leaders, you know, the White Sox have three guys with 100 innings and Cannon's close. And Mets have two, I guess, you know, Singh is one out short. So let's say he has 100 innings as well. So they have three, but nobody else challenging it. Like the Dodgers are always a mess. Like it is, you know, as much money as they spend, especially like in the rotation, like there are only five spots that you can pay guys to have. Like you can't keep buying starters and then not have them start. So I think that that's one of the limitations of having more money than God is like, well, you can, guys want playing time too. And I think, you know, you can spend up and down the lineup and there's rewards there, but I think rotation wise you're limited. And that also makes me wonder, like when it comes to end of season grades, like is this a sneaky good year for Ethan Katz in terms of getting guys to the post and having them effective enough with the lack of name brand recognition? Like bullpen sucked early in the year. So I mean, like that was a case of like, it took a while to figure out the bullpen, but in terms of like the rotation, when you see like other teams, you know, with much deeper pockets struggling to cover innings and cover starts, like the fact that the White Sox have been pretty stable up until now, I think is a feather in their cap.
I would grade him favorably. I think everyone for the White Sox pitching staff, well, with the bullpen we talked about at the beginning of the year, that was more of a talent issue. Nobody really had quality stuff out of the bullpen.
They like were graded out at one point, like halfway through the year, as like the worst stuff of any pitching staff in the major leagues.
Yeah,
and they've added Grant Taylor since then, but and obviously Uendres is unstoppable, but. I don't think they had like seismic change where they're even out of the bottom 10 of the league.
Yeah. Then there's the Brewers. Again, everything's circling back to the Brewers. How fun would it be if the postseason ran through Toronto in the American League and Milwaukee in the National League? I'd love to see the Brewers make it to the World Series. Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin lose their mind. I may even go up. If they even have tickets, drive up to Milwaukee to catch a World Series game if they get that far. But first things first, they got to get their cheeseburgers from George Webb's and see if they can break a new streak as far as longest winning streak in franchise history. They have a very sizable lead over the Phillies. Again, the Phillies and Padres are tied. So we'll see how this weekend goes in Major League Baseball. We will recap the action as it's starting to get really exciting now throughout Major League Baseball as we inch closer to the postseason. But that will do it for this episode of the Sox Machine Podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you just discovered the Sox Machine Podcast, you can subscribe to the show wherever you listen to podcasts, such as Spotify and Apple Music. You can also listen and watch the show on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SoxMachine. Follow us on social media. We're on all the platforms at Sox Machine. You can follow James at JR Fegan, but he's on vacation this weekend, so skip out on that. But you can follow me at SoxMachine_Josh. I'll have plenty of photos and videos from right field of the Savannah Bananas game on Friday night, and I'll also be posting them on our Instagram, which you can follow us on the gram at SoxMachine. We're also on Blue Sky. You can follow us at SoxMachine.com. James is JRFegan.SoxMachine.com. I am Josh.SoxMachine.com. If you enjoy our work and want full access to all of our coverage of the Chicago White Sox and Major League Baseball, you can subscribe to Sox Machine at SoxMachine.com. Monthly plans start at $5. That gets you both an ad-free version of the podcast and the website. And you also have access to our comment section. We also have additional spots remaining in our Veterans Committee. So if you want to be part of our group chat, we're going to be having Sweet Night coming up as well for our VCs. We do have some spots open. You can inquire within at SoxMachine.com. The Sox Machine Podcast is a production of SoxMachine.com. You're on for all things Chicago White Sox baseball and part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. Alongside James Fegan and Jim Margulis, I'm Josh Nelson. Thanks for listening and watching.